It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up later on the program, Alcoa moves its headquarters back home, and a company has been hired to advise the city on the restructuring of the troubled Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. But first, Saturday marks the completion of the first 100 days of the Trump administration, the traditional first grading assessment of a new presidency. At this time, we're going to explore the approach of local media in covering the early days of the Trump administration, his actions, and their potential impact on the Pittsburgh region and Pennsylvania. Joining us in studio, Mila Sanina. She's Executive Director of Public Source. Welcome back to the program, Mila.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And also with us is WESA's News Director, Patrick Doyle. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. I realize that we have two different media organizations represented by you two, Public Source, In-Depth Investigative News, WESA, which has daily, hourly news deadlines, and also produces in-depth stories for broadcast and the web. But the day after the November election, now let me change that. Maybe the Friday after, at the end of the week after that election, did you just sort of breathe a sigh of relief and say, we can gear down, it's okay, now it's back to what we had been doing prior to this long 2016 presidential campaign? Mila, let's start with you.
Well, I think as a lot of newsrooms across the country, there was almost a conversation about what is the purpose of us in Pittsburgh and what is our role as the media organization in the country? You know, how can we cover national policies and the changes that are happening in this new administration and what impact it's going to have on the local region? We have had lots of discussions about, you know, we have been focusing on the urban core of Pittsburgh, but there are regions that we also should be paying attention to, outlining counties adjacent to Allegheny County. So we were thinking that now the role of Public Source should be to convene communities of shared and also not shared vision for the future of the state and for the future of the nation, for the future of the city. And the biggest question was how the policies of the Trump administration are going to trickle down to the local level. So those are the big questions that we asked ourselves. And no, it hasn't slowed down at all. In fact, it has ramped up, and there is more and more need to cover and provide enterprise in-depth reporting on the local level and answer the question of how these national policies are affecting our neighbors, the residents of our city.
I would say I totally agree. It has not ramped down, which, you know, traditionally during an election, there is an intense amount of media focus. News organizations spend a lot of time and reporter resources to cover the actual election. After the election's over, a lot of those people are pulled back and they are focused on other things. That has not happened locally. I don't think it's happened nationally either. There's so many local impacts, as Mila was saying, that just need to be focused on.
What was your approach in covering the transition? So post-election, in preparation for the inauguration and beginning of a new administration?
Well, I think there was another reason for us to remind people why entities like Public Source exist, especially when the president was tweeting so much about fake news and about how every report he didn't agree with or was critical of his actions was called fake news. So there has been an additional role that we needed to play is to explain what fake news is and what it isn't. So that has been important. For us, there was obviously the transition was to really explain and make sense of the panic that a lot of the policies have created, such as, you know, a Muslim ban, the sort of the scare of the potential repeal of Obamacare and what it means to local residents and, you know, climate change, defunding EPA, all of these big questions, what do they mean for the Pittsburgh region? The Muslim community was very concerned, Latino community was very concerned of how the immigration policy would change and that policy is going to affect local residents. So all of these issues have become hyper-local. You know, on the mayoral level and the county level, there were questions about, okay, what if the block grants money are going to disappear? What does it mean for local programs? And, you know, there was also a huge conversation about a sanctuary city status in the city and across the state in Philadelphia. I think there were questions about infrastructure, about focus on rural communities. So there were, you know, it hasn't really, there were so many issues to cover. And I think the transition has not really ended, although it's been 100 days. Public Source did win the grant from the Sprout Fund to cover 100 days. So that's why we have been very laser focused on covering local, you know, implications of the national policies.
How do you approach it? How do you approach your coverage in terms of reactive versus proactive? Reacting to what people are saying, doing marches, protests, as far or the proactive. I wonder what people are thinking. How we've heard this from the incoming president or the new president now in the first 100 days. And what are some of the questions we think we should be exploring?
I think we've been trying to find a balance between those two things. Certainly, we want to cover the community's response. You know, for example, we had the science march, the local science march this past weekend in Pittsburgh. Our reporter Liz Reed went out to cover that. So that's maybe a little more of a reactive story. But earlier in the week, or maybe it was the week before, Liz did this great piece about electricity generation in the western Pennsylvania area. There's been a lot of discussion with the Trump administration wanting to roll back coal regulation. And so we wanted to see, is this actually possible? And she found out, you know, it's pretty hard. Almost all the proposed power generating plants that are coming online or planned are for natural gas or for wind power. So we're trying to balance the proactive and the reactive stories.
Mila, how would you respond to that?
I would say that there is definitely, I agree with Patrick that, you know, there is this importance of highlighting activism that has been really prominently displayed by local communities. You know, there have been more people who were asking themselves this question of what can I do? How can I be influencing and impacting and making a difference in my community? So that's been very positive and needs to be pointed out. And also the question is, you know, every story we approach and we're like, okay, why are we doing this story? Is it redundant? Has it been covered before? What is the longer sort of implications of that story? I think this is also very important. Aside from, you know, talking about potentials, I think that it's very important to also talk about what is the real, you know, sense, even if it's perceived sense. Like I talked about, perceptions of the Muslim community sort of felt animosity and unwelcoming feelings. But, you know, that you also have to highlight and balance it out with the positive response and support that is coming from the local community to the marginalized communities. So every story has to be balanced. You also have to recognize that there has been a population that have felt like, you know, as President Trump would say, forgotten America. There have been a lot of marginalized communities in the city that have been forgotten for years, decades, and felt forgotten. So it's also balancing out, okay, what are the voices that we're not including and the stories that are not being covered with not forgetting about marginalized community that we have been covering and not suddenly shifting our gears completely to focus on, you know, other aspects of our communities.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to get to a couple more points. Did you sense that there would be a strong interest among listeners and readers because Pennsylvania, traditionally blue state, went red? Small margin for President Trump, but still a narrow victory. But also Allegheny County went strong for Hillary Clinton. But Mila alluded to this earlier, a lot of red around Allegheny County. Patrick?
Yeah, I think that you exactly nailed it. Pittsburgh is an interesting place to be because Allegheny County went very strongly for Hillary Clinton. I think she got about 100,000 more votes than Donald Trump did. But so we have this very blue kind of Democratic region, and then there's a vast sea of red basically to Philadelphia, right? So people here have been used to 8 years of the Obama administration. If they're more Democratic leaning, they probably agreed with it generally. And now they're coming to terms with what is happening to my world. What kind of impact are the Trump policies going to have on my community?
Yeah, Mila?
There has been also a lot of conversation about being in a bubble and being cognizant of what is around you. So I think that the mission of ours is also to burst those bubbles and get out of, you know, inform and educate our readers about the circles maybe that are not thinking like them or voting like them, and why are they voting one way or another. There also has been a lot of rationalization in, you know, like a lot of Trump's backers are still backing him, saying that, you know, we appreciate his swagger and that really Obamacare was not repealed because of the Congress and, you know, all of this finger pointing. And I think that it's really important to bring that perspective and to keep people informed. You know, there was recently an article in Politico, I think, that said that a lot of the media centers now, even online media, are centered in, you know, big cities, urban cores. And it's partially sort of explained and rationalized the win of Mr. Trump, that, you know, well, they are not listening to the marginalized communities and forgotten America. So but it's our mission as the media organization to be listening and to be a voice of the voiceless and bursting bubbles and informing people, giving them a more larger scale understanding of the community that they live in.
1 minute left, so I want to get to quick responses from both of you. What are you doing looking forward? You're not stopping after 100 days of this administration, because there's so many major decisions, actions that are still ahead in this administration for our country. So Patrick, we'll start with you, then Mila.
Yeah, I don't see our coverage locally or, you know, NPR's nationally dropping back at all. So far, most of what the Trump administration has done is through executive orders or rolling back Obama-era regulation. They haven't done a lot of legislation yet with Congress. I think once that, or if that picks up, they do have a GOP majority. Clearly, there's going to be a lot of local impacts for what they're doing on the national level.
And Mila, quickly.
I would be really interested to see how the budget is going to play out and how what kind of local impact is going to look like. I also am really interested about what's going to happen to the economy and because it has been doing so well. And also, you know, what is going to, like, the big policy questions, right? What is the now the unforeseen impact of all these sort of potential harms, so to speak, like, you know, a Muslim ban or the threat of such? Will it cause a potential brain drain for the United States or for our region? So all of those potential impacts that we are not yet seeing, I really would like to talk to you and myself in 4 years and really have that conversation.
Mila Sanina is Executive Director of Public Source. Patrick Doyle is WESA's News Director. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Alcoa shifts its headquarters back home. We're going to discuss a major series of stories about Alcoa with the reporters of those stories. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, Alcoa, which moved its headquarters from Pittsburgh to New York about 11 years ago, announced it was moving back to Pittsburgh. We're going to talk briefly about that, but really focus in on a major series of reports on Alcoa's operations elsewhere with the reporters of those stories, Len Baselovic and Rich Lord of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So before we talk about your series, which was extremely enlightening, some quick thoughts. Moving back, is it just a transfer of just, 10 employees? symbolic cost saving, Len?
I think it's mostly symbolic. I think even when they officially moved their headquarters to New York, a lot of the headquarters work remained here. So, and 10 people pretty much makes it symbolic.
Okay. So now let's talk about this Pittsburgh company founded 129 years ago. It's been a global player for most of its existence, including a century in Suriname. What led you guys to wanting to explore the impact of this global industrial giant on a country and its people?
I had kept track of news from this little country of Suriname for some time. And when I saw that Alcoa was pulling out of Suriname, which is on the northern coast of South America, I thought, wow, you know, a lot of people in the metals industry are going to lose their jobs, which seemed a little bit familiar being from here, of course. Right. So as I started to reach out to some of the folks who used to work in the aluminum industry, I learned there was a lot more to the story, that really a Pittsburgh company had come into this country and kind of reshaped it almost entirely to suit its needs, and for better and sometimes for worse, really changed the whole fabric of a small country.
You gentlemen are alluding to, this goes well beyond, the mining of bauxite. Did it just keep getting more ripple effects as you explored and explored and explored, or what?
I think what Rich pointed out about the similarities to Pittsburgh in the steel industry, but then you start to look at the politics of the country of Suriname, the economics of it, the fact that it's not a very diversified economy, so that the impact that they had pulling out was so much more magnified than, say, it would be here in Pittsburgh, where we had alternatives.
Okay, so let's take a look at impacts, if you would, in different areas, whether it's environment to the economy, the transition of an economy from, I guess, a plantation based in that area to industrial, et cetera. You pick the one, Rich, that really piqued your interest, environmental, economic, what? They all tied together?
Well, the thing that really grabbed me in the whole history of Alcoa and Suriname was a dam that Alcoa built and the many ramifications that that dam had. About 50 years ago, Alcoa decided that if it had a power source, it could mine bauxite, it could make it, refine it, it could smelt it into aluminum right there in one spot. So in order to power all that, they built a 1.25 mile long huge dam across the Suriname River. And that flooded an area almost the size of Allegheny County. Before the floods came, that area was inhabited by some people called the Sa'amaka, who were descendants of escaped slaves from the 1700s, lived essentially autonomously in the jungle. A large number of them, 6,000 of the Sa'amaka, had to move to make way for the reservoir, and their culture was completely changed by that one act.
So it's the environmental impact, but also this cultural impact. You know, because we say, okay, you flood something, bad enough, but you're changing the lives and culture of a people.
Yeah, very unequal sharing of the prosperity when you look at the communities relocated because of the dam versus the people who worked for the company, sold to the company, prospered by it. Very unequal sharing. And now the main issue there is who controls this dam.
Okay. I'm going to get to that because that's going to be the future of this country, really. But I also want to ask you, so that's sort of in the column of, I would say, destructive, because we're talking about flooding of an area the size of Allegheny County, the total impact on a people's culture. But there was some constructive, whether it was building of towns, or you also noted in your stories, schools for special needs kids, and even homes for elderly with dementia.
Yeah, the money from aluminum made it possible for a lot of people from Suriname to go to Holland to study, the Netherlands to study, earn college degrees, and either come back or, in some cases, not come back, which is like another familiar Pittsburgh story.
So, yeah. Rich.
Alcoa created the middle class of this country. And that really powered the whole country. To date, half of the country's electricity comes from the dam that Alcoa built. So you can definitely say that our company, Pittsburgh's Alcoa, created many decades of prosperity there for some, but not for all.
We keep hearing that, for some, not for all. So you mentioned who was not benefiting, in fact, who was the detriment to. Any other people other than this particular group of people that lived in the area that was flooded, who else did not benefit? Or who did benefit?
I think if you go out to the east of the country, there's a town called Mongo, which calls itself the Bauxite Town. That's where bauxite mining started 100 years ago in Suriname. And that became a company town, really created, maintained, controlled by Alcoa for the better part of a century. And now, you know, it looks a lot like Braddock. They're tearing down everything that used to be made of steel. The processing facilities are being torn down and sold for scrap. The sewers are overflowing. The housing that was built for the company managers there, for Alcoa's company managers, is inhabited by squatters and is falling apart. That showed so many interesting parallels to what we've seen in some tough spots in our region.
Yeah, I think the Paranam, the other town where the refinery and the smelter were located, we went around with one gentleman and he was just like moved to tears at what used to be there and what is no more, or what the jungle is basically taking over.
Talk to me a little bit about this big power broker, if you would, this international corporation and a government. How strong was this government and did the strength or lack of strength of the government help Alcoa get a lot of what it wanted?
Yeah, I talked with so many people in the government or economists who just said the government, this country, just doesn't have the infrastructure, the knowledge to negotiate with someone like that. Plus, the government is military coups since independence in 75. The leader of those coups is now the elected president serving his second 5-year term. A lot of people saying a lot of the problems are the country's own making for not doing something with this aluminum money that they had.
Compounding that, the deal that controls Alcoa's responsibilities and controls the dam was actually written before this country came into existence. Suriname was a Dutch colony in 1958 when they worked out the terms of a 75-year deal that covers the dam and covers Alcoa's responsibility. In 1975, it becomes an independent country. So now you've got the leaders of a very unsophisticated government negotiating with a very sophisticated company over the terms of a deal that was inked by a colonial power.
In a country that doesn't have an environmental law.
An environmental law, did you just say?
They do not have one.
One. Okay, not multiple, but one. Okay. So I guess the question we really should answer is, so why is Alcoa pulling up stakes?
Well, it's the aluminum business is brutal. Costs, they say that facility was among the highest or the highest in their whole system. They've closed a raft of facilities in the U.S., other countries, Jamaica included. So Suriname is not the lone victim here.
Okay. We just have a couple of minutes left, unfortunately. I wanted to get to this. Did we in southwestern Pennsylvania get a small, and I mean small, taste of what Suriname is going through right now as far as the steel industry basically going belly up, thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs gone, and, of course, brownfields left behind, et cetera, and also having to diversify its economy? Did we get a tiny taste of what they're going through?
Well, picture if we'd gone through what we went through 40 and 30 years ago, but if we were isolated, if no one around us spoke the same language that we did, if there were only 500,000 of us, if we had no eds and meds other than one very small university, and then take it a little bit forward. Now we've, of course, got the shale gas industry that we're working with. They're scrambling through the forest trying to find gold to make up for the aluminum industry they've lost.
And offshore oil drilling. So they're basically still looking at commodities, which Pittsburgh found out you need a little bit more than commodities.
Is there still clinging to any hopes of reviving the aluminum industry? There's still hopes of steel industry. Candidate Trump said I'm bringing back steel. Is there still any of that in Suriname?
I've talked with several people who have very ambitious plans for developing what bauxite's left there. Analysts I've talked with said there's all kind of problems with that.
In the remaining minute, what about the future generation? So I'm sure generations were working for Alcoa. What about this generation and the next generations? What are they going to do?
Right now, they're protesting in the streets because they've got 55% inflation and runaway unemployment, and the capital is racked with protests. If they can get this straight and figure out a way to diversify their economy, build another university, as some people are talking about, get past gold and aluminum, they may have a future.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people there that we've talked to who recognize that a problem and are trying to do with it. It's just a question of whether they can do it within the system that's there right now.
Len Baselovic and Rich Lord are reporters for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, have written a series of stories about the impact of Alcoa in Suriname now that it's ceasing operations after about a century. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your great work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Coming up, weeks after announcing free lead water filters will be available to Pittsburghers, the online application process has begun. That's next when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Lead in water, lead levels in children, and the troubled Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority continue to make headlines. We're going to talk about this week's developments with Rebecca Addison, news editor of the Pittsburgh City Paper. Welcome, Rebecca. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And also in studio is WESA senior reporter Mark Newtbar, covering government and public policy. Mark, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us. Use the hashtag WESA Confluence. Okay, as I said, lots of developments this week. Let's start with the Allegheny County Health Department. Early this week released a lot of data, and Health Director Karen Hacker's conclusion basically was lead levels in tested children have steadily declined in recent years, but she admitted that only about 15% of children had been tested. And she also said not a representative sample, right?
Sure.
Yep.
All right. Anything else from the release of information from the health department, Dr. Hacker, that interested you?
I think the big thing that was most interesting is that she is saying what others have said. This is not something new from the Allegheny County Health Department, that lead paint is a much bigger risk. The actual chips of lead paint that a child might come in contact with, or just the dust from deteriorating lead paint, that is actually a much bigger risk factor than lead in water.
Rebecca?
So I think it's interesting that I had just been doing some research for a story I was working on about lead and radon in schools.
Right.
And I had come across an old story from about 5 years ago talking about this issue, and it had been saying that children's lead levels were testing actually higher here than in Flint, Michigan. So I think the emergence of these new numbers are right to question.
Okay. And Hacker did say, though, and this goes to what both of you were mentioning. She said, I'm going to get this right here. The kids who showed elevated levels of lead, they could not determine that lead in water was the primary cause in any case, but rather it seemed to be or was lead paint chips and soil. So there's still a lot of questions, still a lot of people asking the questions, are you sure or what?
Yeah, it's impossible to overplay the importance of getting lead out of water, right? So I should just say that to start with. But you have to drink a lot of water to have an impact. Even a child, even a small child who absorbs lead faster than I do as an adult. So it is important for us to think about, and it has to get taken care of. But really, we need to look at some of these other things. In that report, 86% of homes in the county were built before 1978, which is when we took all of the lead out of paint, and 60% were before 1950, which is also a pretty important number there, 60%. So it's out there, and I don't know how we get rid of all of it, but you have to do it at least incrementally. Get rid of the parts that you can get rid of. If you can get it out of the water, get it out of the water.
So I think something that Chelsea Wagner has been critical of in the past with the health department is that, yes, lead paint is a huge, you know, cause of lead poisoning, essentially, in children, but that if we can address the lead in the water, then we should be doing that.
Okay, well, let's hear from Chelsea Wagner. She held a news briefing immediately after the health department's announcement, and she said that she was going to do a performance audit.
We will begin a performance audit of its programs, which monitor elevated blood lead levels in children. And we're going to be looking at how they evaluate their risk from lead-contaminated water, as well as from other sources.
So is it that Wagner doesn't trust or just wants to be sure that, hey, we have to take a look at all sources of lead and how they might be impacting us and our children?
Yeah, like I said, this isn't the first time that Chelsea Wagner has been critical of the health department and their role in this lead issue. So I think she's just really checking to make sure that we are looking at all levels of lead from every angle.
Yeah, I'm really not sure what she is going to be able to find. As a performance audit, I don't think the county is doing things wrong. I'm not really sure what Wagner is going to come out of this. She called it. She said she wanted to end the atrocity. That's kind of strong language, and I'm not even sure where that's going. She said that there is an unwillingness to gather data on drinking water. I'm just not sure what a performance audit can really do.
So I think what's interesting is people have criticized her for weighing in on the PWSA issue, and I think what's the point here is that this is something that she can look into because, you know, this is a county authority. So this is something that she can look into and make sure they're doing the right thing.
Right. But also that she saw it and that Karen Hacker, health department director, admitted that the testing was not nearly, as I said earlier, a representative sample of what's going on, and it seemed to be a bit scattered, the testing. So maybe Wagner says, why don't you have a more planned out way to test?
Yeah, and it's interesting, they really focused in on that short period of time when the different chemicals were being used, which could have leached more lead out of these pipes. The question there is, as a statistician, is that a significant enough increase during that time? So they found a very small bump in percentage of lead in those tests, but is that enough?
Okay, so let's get to a Band-Aid, a temporary help, if you would. And one of the temporary fixes or actions to address the level of lead in water was the announcement that PWSA customers would be able to receive free water filters.
What matters most now is to identify the residents of the city who are most at risk and to get filters in their hands as soon as possible.
All right, that was Kevin Acklin, Chief of Staff for Mayor Peduto. The announcement came 7 weeks ago. This week, they put online an application process to get a lead filter water pitcher. 7 weeks, and that's just the application process. Do we know what's taking so long?
So I think one of the issues was that they had actually originally proposed point-of-entry filters.
Right.
And there was some concern that, you know, renters, this was something that their landlords would have to install. And so they wouldn't have the autonomy to protect themselves if their landlords didn't make that choice. So I think what's taken so long is, you know, deciding that tabletop filters might be the better option to protect, you know, the most vulnerable residents. And then the problem now is that these filters have been found to maybe not protect against all kinds of lead, to maybe not filter out, you know, all of the lead.
Yeah, and is this, you called it a Band-Aid, Kevin. It really is. What does a half-gallon pitcher do when you talk about all the different ways that you come in contact with water and all the different ways that it can be absorbed into your body? I realize that they want to prioritize this.
And they want to prioritize with pregnant women, families with young children, and also people that have the lead laterals.
Exactly. And so they say about 7,000 homes with children. I didn't see a number, maybe somebody else in the room did, about the number with the lead laterals. I think one of the things that concerns me, and maybe this isn't your question, but I'm just going to say it anyway, one of the things that concerns me is the people that will go to the website and fill out their applications are probably not the people that most need to have these pictures.
So you're saying knock on people's doors, please use this?
Perhaps, but at least they are reaching out through pediatricians' offices, or at least they say they're going to. I haven't seen any evidence of it, but I also don't believe that they wouldn't do this. So that's a good way to do it. Look, you have a kid. Do you have one of these pictures? No. Here it is.
Okay. We have just a minute and a half left. I want to get to the announcement. They've hired a firm to advise on the restructuring of the PWSA. Whereas the pictures might be a little Band-Aid, this is meant for the long-term process. Rebecca.
Yeah, so they just recently made the announcement of this new management company that's going to help with the restructuring. We don't know very much about this company yet, but I think that they moved pretty quickly on finding a company, and I think that bodes well for the long-term viability of PWSA, that they're not waiting to restructure.
Yeah, they have made it clear that they are not looking for somebody to just take over the system. They're not looking to sell the system, that they are looking to right the ship. So that's something that we probably need to keep a really close eye on, is what kind of reports, what kind of changes come out of this.
The first phase of the work of this company is to be done by the end of the third quarter, and that includes community input. But Rebecca, final thing to you in just 30 seconds. This is a multi-year process, the long-term fix.
Yeah, definitely. I think I was just at a forum last night where the mayor was talking about, you know, how long this is really going to take to fix the lead lines, to rebuild all this infrastructure. And this is not a problem that is going to be fixed in the short term.
Mark?
8-member blue ribbon commission. I'm not sure how blue this commission is. I like the fact that Jared Cohen's on it. He's a good administrator, if nothing else. Nothing against these people, but when you talk about somebody who's really looking at environmental health, somebody who's working for an energy company talking about environmental issues, I'm not sure that that's exactly the people that you want watching over the PWSA.
All right. Mark Neutbar, senior reporter for WESA, covering government and public policy. And Rebecca Addison is news editor for Pittsburgh City Paper. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
And for this week, that is The Confluence. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Katie Blackley produced today's program. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.